Okay, so we're going to have 7 short talks. We're going to start with the ones which are fairly closely related to the session we've just been having. So the first one's going to be by Tassos Fragos on modeling of transient low-mass X-ray in the elliptical galaxies, NGC 3379 and 4278.
So I will talk to you briefly about some work I've been doing lately on modeling the transient behavior of low-mass X-ray binaries and how we can compare our models to observations. And the main key point I want to make is how we can use this comparison to find out something about the relative contribution of the two formation channels for low-mass X-ray binaries through evolution of primordial binaries and dynamical interactions, global clusters, in the observational sets that we have here. So Pepe Fabiano talk to you about the deep center observations for these two galaxies. One of the things that they did is to look for transient sources in these two galaxies. And this is what you see here. These are the sources that look like they could be transient sources because they are going on and off between the different center pointings. And they defined as a transient candidate a source that the flux ratio between the on and off state is above 10, and as a potential transient candidate, something that the flux ratio between the on and off state is above 5. Actually, they did something more complicated than that, but this is the simplified version that I will use to compare with my models. I want to remind you that 4278 has about 4 times more globular clusters and about 2 times more low-mass X-ray binaries. Despite that, the number of transient sources that they found is the same, more or less. Now, in my models, I'm going to use the population models that are described in one of our previous studies, where we're looking at the X-ray luminosities in these two galaxies. And the model I'm going to use for the transient behavior of low-mass X-ray binaries has as following. I'm assuming that during the quiescent phase, the mass that is transferred from the donor star towards the accretor is not actually accreted, but it is accumulated onto the accretion disk. And this is going on until the surface density of the accretion disk reaches a maximum value that is set by the ionization of the hydrogen or helium, whatever is the accretion material. And the additional ingredient that we want to put here is what's the duty cycle. And we have this prescription that the duty cycle is proportional to the mass loss rate of the donor squared, which is an empirical relation from hydrostimulation of dwarf nova instabilities by Dobrovsky et al. Knowing all these things, we can calculate the quiescent time and the outburst duration for each one of the the transients of our population. So the probability that we detect the transient is simple, is the duty cycle of the transient given that its luminosity, that its outburst luminosity is above our detection limit. But the probability that we identify a source as a transient source is more complicated, and it depends on the exact timing of the multiple observations that we do and the properties of the binary. So for each one of our binaries, we're doing a Monte Carlo simulation to calculate this probability, and then we're doing a second Monte Carlo simulation to find out how many transients we would observe in this galaxy. And this is the result. This is the probability density function of the number of identified transient sources in each one of the two galaxies. The vertical lines are the actual observations. What we're showing here is that when we normalize our population to the mass, we get good agreement with the observations. When we normalize it to the actual number of observed, total number of observed sources, for 4278, we get something that is way overproducing. And I'm going to close with the main key point that I tried to make at the beginning. It seems like the number of transient sources is proportional to the mass of the galaxy, and not to the number of globular clusters. And this actually agrees with the number of sources that our models predict, and our models are taking into account only prime order binaries. And finally, our comparison suggests that low mass XA binaries are formed through evolution of primordial binaries in globular in globular cluster poor galaxies, while even the globular cluster rich ones, they seem to have a significant contribution. We can still see them there.
Let's thank Tassos. Do we have any questions? Okay, Steve?
So I think this means that if we find transients, they should be in the field, right?
Mainly in the field.
So I don't, is this true?
It is, I have them here. So in each one of the galaxies, out of 8, we find 1, and out of 6, we found 1.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, I just have a quick question about the observations. Is the luminosity threshold the same in each epoch in both of these galaxies?
No, but through their analysis, they took this into account. Because they were counting the flux ratio of on and off, they were removing the source. Probably Nikki is the best person to give the details on this. Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Okay, I actually even have one more. So in the modeling you're doing, mm-hmm. what do you get for a relationship between the peak luminosity of the transient outburst and various other parameters? Do you find one?
Oh, yeah. Doing the assumption that I said, that during quiescent I don't accrete anything and during outburst I'm emptying my disk, mm-hmm. What I'm actually getting for the luminosity is the mass loss rate of the donor divided by the duty cycle, mm-hmm. and that's transformed to LX.
Okay, right. So does that turn out to give a LX peak orbital period relation like is seen in the data? At least it's seen in the data for the galactic transients. Maybe you haven't checked that yet.
In the galactic transients, you don't really know very well the distance. So.
Well, but that's true, but it's not true enough to matter. There's a strong correlation that isn't that dependent on the distance in the galactic transients.
I haven't looked at it.
Okay,
but
so,
so
that might be interesting.
Transfer rate depends on the period, so you will see some correlation. I just haven't seen it.
You haven't looked for it, or you?
Yeah, I haven't looked for it.
Okay. Okay, that might be interesting to look at. If there are any other questions in the audience? Okay, if not, it'll be Mark Peacock next. And while Mark is speaking, if Jimmy Irwin could come up and get his computer plugged in, and the same on the future talks, so that we cut out the Slack time as much as possible. Appreciate that. So Mark's presentation is going to be M31 globular clusters and the relationship between low mass extra binaries, mass, and stellar collision rate.
Okay, thanks, Tom. So I'd just like to briefly mention some work we've been doing on the M31 globular cluster system with my collaborators who are listed at the bottom there. I've only got a few minutes, so I'm not going to give much of an introduction, but just to mention our reasoning behind doing this. The Milky Way only has relatively few globular clusters and only 13 low mass extra binaries. So if we want to increase our sample, what we really want to get is the structural parameters of extragalactic clusters. So we decided to look at the M31 clusters. Now, the advantage they have is because they're proximity to us, we can actually measure their structural parameters using ground-based photometry. And we did this using the wide-field camera on the UK infrared telescope. So I've given some details about the data we used here. so that you can compare it to other work which has been done on trying to model the King parameters of clusters. So our seeing varied between 0.6 and 0.9 arc seconds, and that corresponds to a spatial resolution at M31 of 2.1 parsecs and 3.4. So you can compare that, for example, with HST at SEN A, which we're only slightly worse than, and at the Virgo cluster galaxies, where we're significantly better in spatial resolution. We also are very well sampled with a pixel size of 0.2 arc seconds, and cover the whole globular cluster luminosity function with very good signal to noise. We go two magnitudes fainter than the faintest clusters we expect. So using the codes developed by Chris Walters, which you mentioned in his talk on Tuesday, we fit King models to these data, and that gives us the structural parameters of 239 of M31's globular clusters. So next, we use this data to look at the low mass X-ray binaries in these clusters. 15 of our clusters have already been identified to host low mass X-ray binaries. So as has been mentioned in lots of talks previously, low mass X-ray binaries are known to be very abundant in globular clusters, and it's thought this is due to diamical formation in their cores. If this is the case, then we'd expect there to be a relationship between the stellar collision rate in the cluster, given generally by this gamma parameter. So we can use our fits to these clusters to measure, to calculate gamma. And I'd just like to mention here that because of our greater spatial resolution over the Virgo galaxies, and in most cases, possibly the exception of Chris's data, which is very deep, we have better signal to noise. So we think we can get this gamma parameter very well. So the results of doing this, what I've plotted here is on the left the stellar collision rate of all clusters of the open histograms, and the LMXB hosting clusters are the filled histograms. And on the right is the magnitude of these clusters. So we can see that clearly the LMXB hosting clusters have high stellar collision rates, and they're the brightest clusters. So we want to investigate which of these parameters is the more fundamental relating to why LMXBs are in the clusters. So what we did next was to plot up these two parameters against each other. And on the bottom here, we have the magnitude, which I've reversed. So the brightest clusters are on the right. And we can see that, yes, clearly they're brighter and higher stellar collision rate. But there's clearly a relationship between these two parameters. And we can see that if we look at this relationship, it appears that the LMXBs are shifted towards the higher stellar collision rate clusters for their mass. So we detrend this data on this best fit line, which we find for it, and find that this is a statistically significant offset by using a KS test. I should also point out there's some ambiguity in where you choose the line due to the large spread in these parameters, but we're consistent to different gradients, we still get this relationship. So just to leave you with my summary, we found the structural parameters of 239 clusters around M31. The LMXBs in these clusters are found to lie in the more massive clusters and those with higher stellar collision rates. And we find the LMXB hosting clusters generally have higher stellar collision rates than average for their mass. And we suggest that considering the relationship between these two parameters, the stellar collision rate is the more fundamental parameter related to the formation of LMXBs. So if you want more details, there's a poster out in the poster hall and a paper that we've written on this, so you can get more there. I'll just leave you with the poster so you can see what that looks like.
Okay, so let's thank Mark.
So how many square degrees of M31 were surveyed in this way?
It covers, right, so there's gaps in the data, but it covers about 1.5 degrees by about 2 degrees. But there were pointing errors in the observations, so the clusters we don't cover are basically just, they're strips. So it covers most of the system, but there's gaps in it.
And what's your estimate for the total number of clusters in M31? Do you have a ballpark number for that?
Well, the catalog we were using was the Galletti catalog, the Blondie.
So you didn't survey, you pointed.
We covered just the whole disk, right? Wide-field camera's got a 0.8-degree field of view, so we basically covered the whole thing.
Yeah, if I could just interrupt, it's a little more complicated than that. I hope you don't mind. We did survey, but there was an error in the scripts that were used for the service time observations in the first few weeks of UKIRT service time observations, where these data happened when taken, and they corrected for the cosine delta change when they, it's a paw print thing, and then they shift around to fill in the image plane, and they put in the cosine delta term in the wrong direction, so we get strips with gaps in between. And they've corrected that, but I think you haven't finished analyzing that, right?
No, we've got more data which fills it in, so there will be more clusters coming on. But the clusters that we use, we just use the existing catalogs currently. We are looking at possibly seeing the contamination in the old catalogs and things.
Ivan?
Sometime in the late 80s, Francois Schweitzer published a paper showing that if you convolve King models with point spread functions, you couldn't recover correctly any core radii that were smaller than the core of the point spread function. Are you well within that criterion? On the good side of it, I mean.
So most of our core radii will be smaller than our seeing. So we're relying on fitting models to the rest of it and convolving it together.
All right.
Just a quick question. Did you also by any chance see the trends with respect to the cluster density versus velocity? There's the binary single encounter rates.
The
cluster density versus the velocity dispersion.
We don't have velocity dispersions of them.
So I'm talking about the rho square V by RC times RCQ, right?
Sorry, the gamma parameters that we have. Are you talking about this one? Yeah. Or
well, that comes from the, from the video relation.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just asking, using the same video relation, rho by V can be also be expressed in that form.
Yes.
So I was just thinking of whether what is there any kind of trend with in with the numbers and other quantities with that quantity, rho by V.
With what parameters in particular? Between gamma and other.
Not this gamma. I mean rho by V, another quantity. There is a binary single encounter rate that we also talked about. So the number, how the number depends on that.
Okay. I don't know.
Okay, first you have to answer question one. How long does the low mass X-ray binary remain luminous? Bright? A giga-year? Three?
I think it can vary, I don't know if that's accurately known.
Then here's my comment. As some other people in the audience know, that the published M31, the Galetti catalog, mm-hmm. is full of objects of a wide range of age.
Sure.
And the ones that overlay the disk of M31 in particular are not old globular clusters. They're much younger objects, which in many cases are not centrally concentrated. They're young clusters.
Yeah.
So if these things only last for 3 giga-years, then your statistics, when you compare the statistics between the M31 system as measured by the Galetti catalog, right, the fraction of clusters that host these things, is going to be biased by the fact that the age distribution of what you're looking at in M31 may be quite different from the age distribution of the pure classical globular cluster catalogs like you find in the Harris database.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we're only looking at the M31 stuff here, but yeah, the ages is something else that we're going to look at, that I'm looking at the moment, in fact, trying to find the ages of them.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't trying to say that.
Yeah, I think the other thing is you compared with HST results on several clusters and got the same answers, right?
Yes, it's consistent with with the ones that's been done with HST.
Okay, did Steve say the same thing you were gonna? Okay, do we have one more or should we move on to Jimmy Irwin? Okay, let's thank Mark again. Okay, and while Jimmy is speaking, if Andreas could get his computer set up. Discreetly. There's three slots for computers here, so what I meant by getting your computer set up, if you're the next speaker, is actually come up and plug it in, and then you can just press a button to switch which slot is active.
I was hooked up earlier.
Shall we by Jimmy Irwin, emission lines from extragalactic globular cluster, possible evidence for stellar disruption by intermediate mass black hole. So take it away, Jimmy.
Right. Today I'll be talking about a very unusual extragalactic globular cluster that harbors not only an ultra-luminous X-ray source, but also has strong optical emission lines, which we don't generally expect from globular clusters. Notice the title of my talk has a question mark in it, so I'm going to feel free to be very speculative in my conclusions about it, what I think it might be. I'm going to talk about it in terms of possibly this providing evidence for stellar disruption of a white dwarf by an intermediate mass black hole within this globular cluster. Now, the source in question is CXO J03-3831.8. It's within a globular cluster in the elliptical galaxy in 4NX NGC 1399. On the left is the Chandra image of the field. The source in question is here in the inset. It's been observed like 7 or 8 times with Chandra over the years. It's always been on. It's always had a luminosity in excess of 10 to the 39 Earth per second. And it's somewhat variable. So given its very high luminosity and its variability, we're pretty confident that we're looking at a single black hole accretor in this system. Now, the source resides within a globular cluster, seen here from the HST image. It's fairly luminous, fairly red globular cluster, but not necessarily extreme in any of those values compared to the NGC 1399 globular cluster population as a whole. Now, we've obtained two optical spectra of this globular cluster with the Magellan 6.5 meter telescope, earlier with IMAX and more recently with MAGE, which has better spectral resolution. Shown here, the spectra is from the MAGE observation, and we find two strong optical emission lines, the oxygen 3 doublet around 5,007 angstroms and the nitrogen 2 doublet around 6,600 angstroms. Both lines have a luminosity of around 10 to the 36 Earth per second. The velocity of these lines are all consistent with the same value, consistent with NGC 1399 itself. So we know that this object is in 1399 and it's not a background AGN. That's masquerading as an NGC 1399 source. In addition to these strong optical forbidden emission lines, the other striking feature of the spectrum is there's absolutely no trace of any H-alpha or H-beta for that matter. We can put a lower limit on nitrogen 2 to H-alpha of at least a factor of 16. From the line diagnostics of nitrogen 2, we can set an upper limit to the temperature of about 13,000 degrees Kelvin if we assume a single temperature for the nebula that's from which the emission lines are emanating. And from the width of the lines, we find that the velocity half width is about 75 kilometers per second. So due to lack of time, I don't want to go into great detail as to why we think that the optical and the emission lines don't come from two separate objects or from a supernova or from a planetary nebula. There's more information out on my poster outside if you want more details on that. But we were forced to consider more exotic explanations to account for both the high X-ray luminosity and the optical emission lines. So one idea that we've been considering is perhaps we are seeing a star that has been disrupted by an intermediate mass black hole within this globular cluster. And debris from this white dwarf is being illuminated by the X-rays coming from the accretion disk around the black hole. Now, we say white dwarf because that would explain the lack of any H-alpha or H-beta emission lines that we think should accompany the oxygen and the nitrogen lines. Now, this may seem like a kooky idea, but actually, in recent years, there's now a growing number of papers that have been published that are investigating that if intermediate mass black holes exist within the centers of globular clusters, they should occasionally disrupt a passing star. So given the timescales over which one would expect this, it's not unreasonable to think that given the 10 or 20,000 or so globular clusters that are around galaxies in our local neighborhood, that on a human timescale, we might see a few of these disruption events going on. Now, the general schematic of this is taken from Loeb and Almer. This originally was for a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole in the center of a galactic nucleus, but there's no reason why this argument can't be scaled down to a 10 to the 3 solar mass black hole within a globular cluster. So the models predict that initially, when the star is torn apart, some of the debris will go into an accretion disk around the black hole and begin to feed it. And you'll have an Eddington flare from the source that lasts several months. However, very recent simulations by Ramirez and Roswag have found that even after several centuries, the source could still be a 10 to the 39 ergs per second source. That's exactly what we have here. So it passes the first criteria. The models also predict that other parts of the debris will go to larger radii and form a low density photosphere with a temperature of about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. This could be these optical emission lines are coming from, debris left over from the disruption that's gone to larger radii. So we have that too. Now, point out another a variant on this model is if a white dwarf gets too close to the intermediate mass black hole, rather than simply disrupt the star, it's possible that tidal compression will cause a underluminous type 1a supernova. We do not think that's the case for our source because it would predict a wide line of several thousand kilometers per second. But I'll get back into a second in a minute as to why I think that why I brought that up. Now, the only other source that is even remotely like this is an X-ray source in RZ2109, a globular cluster in NGC 4472 that Steve Zepp and Tom McRone and others have worked on. Both are ULXs in globular clusters. Both have strong O3 emission, and both show this very strange lack of any hydrogen line. They're also quite different in the sense that there's no nitrogen 2 in RZ2109, and the width is much, much greater than ours. Okay, so we're not certain that these two objects are described by the same event. Okay, that's still up in the air now. But it's fun to think, can we come up with an idea that describes both objects in the same terms of tidal disruption? I know there's a poster outside by Matthew Steele that goes into much more about this source. Maybe not so much in terms of a disrupted intermediate mass black hole, but maybe a 10 solar mass black hole that is accreting at Eddington or maybe even super Eddington rate and is blowing a wind out, which would be responsible for these very high width lines for their observation. One thing I want to throw out there, and I put two question marks here to mean that it's very, very speculative, is that perhaps we're seeing in RZ2109 actually one of these type 1a induced supernova from a white dwarf getting too close to an intermediate mass black hole. That would explain nicely these wide lines and the very strong oxygen 3 emission that they see. So we've begun a program to try to find more of these objects. So far, we've looked at about 10 objects that have X-ray luminosities between 1 and 5 times 10 to the 39 Earths per second. We have not yet found any more of these emission line objects, but we will continue to search for them. And I'll just show up here the difference between a tidal shredding scenario and a black hole wind scenario, what we should expect if we have a greater number of sources, both how many we should find and the location, whether they should always be in globular clusters or if you should find them in the field also, should give us a better handle on exactly what these are, whether they are a tidal shredding event or a black hole wind. Thank you.
Okay, Ivan.
On the basis of this one case, can you make an estimate of what fraction of globular clusters would contain intermediate mass black holes?
What fraction should? I wouldn't go far as I could say that intermediate mass black holes should be in all globular clusters. Given the number of disruptions one would expect, it's a pretty wide range. It should happen in each globular cluster. If every globular cluster has an intermediate mass black hole, you expect a disruption anywhere between once every 10 to the 5 to 10 to 9 years. So it's a huge range. They might only remain X-ray active and optical emission line active for only a few centuries. So we really don't know how many of these we should expect at any one time. So far, we haven't found very many, but we haven't looked very hard for more yet.
Some technical thing. In terms of the absence of the Balmer lines, have you thought about that could be due to filling in from the underlying stellar population? You know, Balmer line, in the underlying stellar population.
Yes. Well, the absorption line would be narrower than the emission line. If the emission line is as wide as the nitrogen 2 lines, you should see a peak and then a dip in the center. We don't see anything like that. So I would say you probably couldn't hide too much H-alpha emission or H-beta emission from absorption. The line is about 3 times the spectral resolution of the instrument.
I had a different question. But on that point, Matt Steele's poster in our paper both discussed this for 2 different sets of data, and we take the stellar populations models and fold them through and do the whole thing. And it's an issue of limits, right? There's no solid detection. In fact, their newer data makes it seem like there's even less hydrogen than we thought before. About the supernova possibility, and just in general, I'm not sure what we'd expect for the lifetime of really broad lines. But our line has been bright in O3 for at least 5 years now. We don't know exactly how broad it was in initial data, but it's a pretty long time to keep something so bright and broad. And another difference between the two is the RZ2091 is about a factor of 10 brighter in O3.
Hi, Jimmy. Certainly nice to talk to my fellow Michigan native when the temperature is 70 degrees instead of 10. So my question is, the color that you showed there, you said your B minus V color, where V606 is 0.5, so it's a metal-rich cluster. And there's a difference between V555 and V606, if I remember, is of about 0.3. So that's an incredibly blue cluster, if I remember my B minus Vs for extragalactic clusters. So my question was along the lines of Paul. So could it actually be that this is a young cluster, you have a heck of a lot of Balmer lines getting filled in, because it seems to be really blue if it's a metal-rich cluster?
The value I had for B minus V was some values that Andy Patak had.
But you had V606. V606 is 0.3 off from regular V. That's an important point to remember. 0.3 is a huge.
Okay, I've located this source on your B minus I plots in one of your papers, and it is red.
Okay.
I can tell you that. Yeah, if I could put the minus
half here. Then it's not V606, then he's converted the V606 to...
So this is probably a stupid question, but so you need this to be a white dwarf event, obviously, because you see no hydrogen for one thing. But how many main sequence tidal disruptions would you expect, given that those are much more frequent, presumably, and would they look anything like this or completely different? Or
I don't know offhand how many main sequence disruptions we would expect relative to the white dwarfs. You would expect, through the mass segregation, that you might have more white dwarfs in the center. Okay. So short answer, I don't know the ratio, but if it were main sequence, then definitely we would expect to see the hydrogen lines.
I think his question was, given that you see one of these, do you expect to see a huge number of main sequence events?
So I had two quick questions. One, did you see sulfur 2, or were you not sensitive to it? And secondly, did you actually calculate what, with cloudy or something, what you'd actually expect if you put material in the light of an X-ray source like this?
There is no sulfur 2 at the same. Basically the same upper limit as we have in the H-alpha. And no, we haven't done cloudy yet, but that is on our list of things to do.
Okay, real quick, Steve. We are doing cloudy, and this is one of these that become more convinced that it has to be hydrogen poor, but I can get rid of everything else with lots of free parameters.
Okay. All right, let's thank Jimmy again. Okay, and next presentation will be by Andreas Zezos. Andreas is speaking, if Saurav Chatterjee come up and plug in his computer so that we don't have too long a delay.
Thank you.
Andreas is going to talk spatial distribution of X-ray sources in NGC 4261.
Okay.
Take it away, Andreas.
I'll continue the same theme that Nikki started in the previous session. So I'll discuss about the spatial distribution of the X-ray sources in NGC 4261, which is one of the first galaxies that could discover the funny spatial distribution. So some introduction. NGC 4261 is a nearby galaxy in the outskirts of Virgo. It was observed with Chandra because it's a famous AGN and has a very nice, impressive jet. Otherwise, it's a rather boring elliptical with a very low fine structure. As defined by Francois Weiser, has a fine structure of 1 just because it has some boxiness in its center. It was also discovered it has a counter-rotating core, but otherwise it doesn't show any ribs, it doesn't show any shells, it doesn't show anything interesting otherwise. So we had an initial observation of 35 kiloseconds with Chandra, and we discovered 45 sources, X-ray sources, down to a luminosity of about 10 to the 38 per second. And this is the X-ray image. So the first thing that becomes clear from this image is that there is a big hole here of X-ray sources, and there is an arc of X-ray sources in this direction. So actually, there was a summer student who was working on the AGN. And when she showed me this image, I thought, oh, nice spiral galaxy. She said, no, it's an elliptical. So we tried to quantify the significance of that. So here are the X-ray sources with the D25 area overlaid on a DSS image. So we tried to quantify the significance of this excess. And we ran a KES test comparing the position angle of the sources with the distribution of the position angle of X-ray sources drawn from the optical light of the galaxy. So, and this is the KES test, and you see it's hugely different. So we get a probability of less than 0.1% that the two distributions are consistent. This was independently confirmed by Giordano et al. In 2005, who also pointed out that these sources are consistent with candidate global clusters based on ground-based data. So Intrigued by this result, we proposed for deeper observations. So a few months ago, we obtained a 100 kilosecond Chandra observation with ACCS. So here is a true color image with red the soft band, green the medium band, and blue the hard band X-ray photons, where you see the nice nucleus, you see the jet here, and lots of dots. So when you do the source detection, and again, the green ellipse shows the D25 ellipse, and the white circles show the X-ray sources, and the size of the ellipse is proportional to the luminosity of the source. Now here we excluded the nuclear region because of source confusion and also the jet region, which is also resolved into hotspots. So we don't want really to confuse X-ray sources. So what becomes apparent now is that there are a few more sources that popped up here. In contrast to what we had before, there was a big hole. So we do detect now 66 sources down to 7 × 10⁻³⁰ times 10⁻³⁷ Hz per second. And in addition to the HST data, we have HST with PIC2 BVI images, which reach 25 magnitude in V-band. And thanks to those, we can identify 7 background AGN, which are X-ray sources. And also, we find that most of our X-ray sources have optical counterparts. I cannot say if most of them are global clusters because we haven't finished the analysis of the HST data. But many of those actually are fuzzy blobs, so they are global clusters. So now, performing the same tests as in the earlier data set, we find a lower significance that the X-ray sources are follow the starlight. And also, we do not find very much, very big difference between the luminous sources. By that, I mean the sources that are down to 10⁻³⁸, which is the detection limit that we had in the original observation, and the starlight. But we find that the low luminosity sources are less consistent with the starlight. So these are probabilities that the two populations are different. Also, we do not find much difference between the sources which are associated with optical, which have optical counterparts, and the ones which are not. Now, one caveat, this probability and this probability here are probably very low because we have very few sources. Here we have only 12 sources, and here we have about 10 sources. So the KS test really breaks down all the limits. So the result is that now with the deeper data, the difference between the distribution of the X-ray sources and the optical satellite is less striking than the shallow observation. And also that X-ray source variability, the new sources that popped up in this region, actually may play some role in that. However, the asymmetry seems to hold for the fainter sources. So our immediate plan is to do a more robust clustering analysis to see if indeed we have a clustering of sources here that is not detected by just averaging all the sources within the radial azimuthal beams. And also compare with, do the same analysis for the optical clusters from the HST data and see if there is any trend with the different population of the global clusters. Thank you.
Thank you, Andreas. Okay.
One quick remark about the KS test. When you have numbers of tens of percent, it means that the test is valueless.
Exactly.
The test can
only
exclude things. It cannot include them.
I agree. Yeah. That's why, actually, I don't really believe that the distributions in the new data are very different. We have to run something more careful, more robust test.
So, Andres, other than just the when you say the spatial distribution, you might want to do also the azimuthal distribution of clusters, because when you actually do this in HST data, I did this early on, the clusters also seem to be slightly flattened. They're not always circular. Even things like M87, the cluster system is not completely spherical. You might want to do that.
Okay, yes. I mean, that's the thing we're going to do. Once we identify a good catalog of clusters, that's the next thing we're going to do.
Okay, I want to ask a quick one.
Sure.
Can you go back to the first plot where you showed the smooth image?
Lisa?
No, further back. Go to the top of the talk. That one, yeah. This stuff that looks like diffuse emission there, is that real gas emission or is that just...
Yes,
okay, so this thing is following some gas trail.
Well, this is a bit of a smooth here. The gas that we really believe is the one down here, which is really interesting actually because it has an X structure. So it looks like there is a hole here blown by the jet.
Okay, wait, but is this stuff gas? Or is that just an artifact of the smoothing process?
It's an artifact of the smoothing process.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
The radio lobe runs here, here.
Okay, so the radio lobe is where the hole is.
Okay. Here's the jet.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. If not, the next presentation will be back. Oh, thank Andreas. Okay. The next presentation will be by Saurav Chatterjee. Entitled, oh no, that's Jamie's. Okay, which button are you on?
Four.
Okay, and if Adrian could come up and get her computer set up during one of the next two talks, I'd appreciate that. Okay, so dynamical consequences of the top-heavy IMF, runaway, the case of the Arches star cluster. Okay, so take it away, Saurav.
Thank you. So recently we started studying the effects of the assumed initial mass function on the dynamical evolution of cluster. And as a first exercise, we chose the Arches cluster because of its unusual top-heavy IMF. A mass function near the central region of the cluster. So just a few points to remind you which are relevant for this talk. So Arches cluster is very young. It's about between 2 to 3 million years old. The half mass, it's pretty compact. The half mass radius is about 0.35%. And the top heavy mass function is found near the central region of the cluster. And the central region of the cluster mass function, observed mass function looks something like this. So the interesting part here is this part where it becomes flat in this range of mass. So there are before I go into the story, I just wanted to show you how the shape compares with two different standard mass functions. This is saltpeter. This is the Krupa IMF in this mass range. And the top heavy mass function in Arches looks something like this. So there are two different schools of thought how this top heaviness came. And Puthis Duart did some work saying that this top heaviness came just through dynamical evolution. It started with some standard Krupa or Scalo initial mass function, and just through dynamical evolution, it attained the mass function that we observe today. And Deeb et al. Proposed that this top heaviness near the center of the cluster can be primordial. So the idea there was the pre-stellar core in the molecular cloud, they collapsed to form stars, and they also collide with other pre-stellar cores, and how massive these pre-stellar cores can be depends on how quickly they collapse or how quickly they can collide with other pre-stellar cores. And each pre-stellar core produces only one star, and if the pre-stellar cores can collide before they collapse, then they make a more massive pre-stellar core, and that makes a more massive star. And just with these assumptions, they could show that the cluster has been born with this mass function. Now, we assume that if this top heaviness near the center of Arches is primordial, then what are the dynamical consequences? So we went ahead and did some in-body simulations. We chose a King profile with W naught equals 8. The total number of initial stars is 64K. The virial radius is 0.5%. And then we looked at two different scenarios. One is the initial mass function is independent of radius, and it's regular Krupa throughout the cluster. And the other case is the observed ArcGIS cluster mass function. So for the regular Krupa, the two most massive stars grew like this. So for the next three plots, I show the mass growth of two most massive stars in the cluster over time. And this is what happened for the regular Krupa IMF. For the ArcGIS IMF, it is drastically different. Two stars can become very massive. One star grew almost up to 1,000 solar mass. The other was somewhere near 300 solar mass. With another realization of the same ArcGIS IMF, we find the same runaway scenario. Now, another interesting thing I want to point out that not only one runaway is, not only one star is becoming very massive, it's actually more than one. And in this case, these two stars collided around here. And the average time between collisions is somewhere near 0.1 million years. And that is, so the stars get some time to become stars again and start burning helium. So that can have some consequences. And the take-home point I want you to remember is just this.
Thanks, Rav. Okay, Judy, then John.
I don't think you mentioned this. Isn't ArcGIS the cluster very close to the galactic center?
It's very close from the galactic center.
Yeah, so it lives in a very peculiar environment where it may be that the IMF is not normal because of the environment rather than...
Well, so it can be, but so basically in this study, we do not try to figure out why the IMF is weird or what are the reasons why this mass function came to be. This was just saying that, okay, so if the mass function we observe now, if we believe Deeb et al.'s work, then we say that the mass function we observe today may be primordial, and what are the consequences of that on the dynamics if this is primordial?
So if you take the currently observed mass function and call that your initial mass function, so you start your simulation with that at time zero, what mass function do you get in your simulation at 2 million years, which is the age of the cluster currently?
That is,
and the reason that's important, obviously, is because stellar evolution timescales for these massive stars are comparable.
Right. I haven't plotted that yet, but what I can tell you is, so since this is in body units, let me tell you what the physical units here are. So 2 million year is somewhere around here. So you can see that at present time, it is possible to have a very massive star there. I have also checked that the virial radius up to around here does not change much. It stays near 0.5%, where we started with. But I haven't plotted the mass function yet.
But okay, do we have any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Sarav again. And let's welcome Jamie Lombardi, who's going to talk about runaway collisions and multiple populations in globular clusters.
So I know we're anxious. Is this on? So I know we're anxious to eat, so I'll just start to talk. We are at Allegheny College. It's an undergraduate institution in Western Pennsylvania. I want to give thanks to a couple undergraduates, one of them who's currently working with me on this project. It's an ongoing project. We're looking at runaway collisions, and I want to present to you an idea as how they may be related to this multiple populations that have been observed in globular clusters. So first of all, let me say what the scenario we used to start out these collisions were. We took a simulated cluster from the work of Freitag et al. And the idea here is a very compact, very dense cluster, because we were trying to get stars to collide together frequently enough that the time between their collisions might be shorter than the thermal relaxation time scale, right? Because when these two stars collide together, what we're going to do is turn around, take the collision product, collide it with another star, collide it with another star. And indeed, that can happen in some of these extreme cases. So over on the right here, what we have is just a little diagram. As you go downward on this diagram, you're going forward in time. As you go to the right on this diagram, you're giving to more and more massive stars. And you can see a very low mass star collides with a heavy star, and they make a very slightly heavier star. And then that star collides with another, that collides with another. On down the chain, there are 100 collisions or so before you get to the end of this runaway collision sequence. And they did this with the sticky sphere approximation. Two balls collide together, they make a bigger ball, so to speak, right, where you conserve mass and momentum in the process. We wanted to look at this with our hydrodynamics code. So let me just show you a few of the collisions that were in a chain. I pick one star that ultimately is going to end up in the collision object, and I follow it through a few collisions. Here I'm not showing you the first couple, they're rather boring. You know, a massive star collides with a 0.1 solar mass star, and basically nothing changes. Here's the third star in the chain. These are actually two runaway collision objects, so they've both already suffered previous mergers. One of them's 111 solar masses, one of them's 106 solar masses. I think the 106 is in the upper right. The colors here represent column densities. So they hit off-axis. We take the initial conditions from the simulations of Freitag et al. And in the end, we get a larger object. It's not a star, right, because it's thermally puffed up. It's 208 solar masses. If something like this were to start to contract down to the main sequence, you're going to lose a lot of mass through winds. We have radiation pressure in the code here. And indeed, if you start to allow this thing to settle down, you do see those winds kick on. You do see mass loss. But this is hydrodynamically stable. There's only about 4% mass loss in the collision. This first collision that I've showed you here. So now you take this 208 solar mass runaway collision object, and that comes along, and 50 kilo years later, so it's a fairly short amount of time, right, starting to be comparable to the thermal time scale, it collides with another object. It's 109 solar masses. And this is our collision object up here from the previous collision. Notice that it's nice and distended, right? And in fact, that is going to make these collision rates even higher than what you would get in some of these sticky sphere approximations, where they choose radii, which would be something like a thermally relaxed star, or something which is smaller than the effective collision radius of some of these products. So here you, again, have an off-axis collision. These stars will make several passages around one another before ultimately they merge into form a single object. Here we get 19% mass loss in that particular collision. You take that collision object, and you collide it with the next one, right? There's other collision objects around, so you're colliding almost 300 with an almost 200, and you make a 300 solar mass collision object, and you get more mass loss, now almost up to 30% in the collision. But still, the masses of these objects are getting larger and larger. And this will be the final visualization I'll show you, and then there'll be one more slide after this. We collide a 200 and a 300, and you get a 350 solar mass collision object. All right, 32% mass loss. So with each collision that you have in this chain, you get more and more mass loss. But it doesn't totally shut down, at least as far as we've followed it through so far. It doesn't totally shut down the increase in the mass of the runaway object. So this is my final slide here. It's just a proposed mechanism for how you might think about how this could help to generate multiple populations in a cluster. We know these collisions are going to occur. So the question is, you know, what's going to happen to this mass here? It's a tough problem, but maybe it's something like the following. You start with your gaseous cloud that's collapsing down to form your cluster. You have your star formation, but you're also generating runaway collision objects in the core. These runaway collision objects aren't going to easily be stable. They're going to eject this helium-enriched gas into the local environment through winds, through rotational breakup as they collapse down. And so now you've got this pool, if you will, of helium-rich gas from which a second generation of stars can start to form. Then you have your first supernovae, which evacuate the area. You're left with a large cluster, and then over giga years, as the cluster evolves, it loses its outer layers of stars, and you have a more one-to-one type ratio of the first and second generation stars.
All right, let's thank Jamie. Thanks, Saraf.
So how much mass loss happens after a collision? How does it depend on how quickly that collision happened after the collision before?
The first collisions you have are always very low in the amount of mass loss. It's a few percent. And as you get later and later in the collision sequence, it grows more. And that's simply because the stars you're colliding have these large gaseous envelopes that are just very loosely bound onto the collision product. So it becomes a lot easier to knock tens of percents of mass off.
So this might not be even relevant. So Mark Freitag did some work, and there at some point, so he also studied really dense clusters. So the time between two collisions were of the order of the thermal relaxation time scale.
Right.
So he at some point mentions that these envelopes can be so puffed up then that other stars can just pass through it and there will be no collision. And
Well, that can happen. All okay. Possibilities you can imagine can happen. But you would also likely strip off some of the gas in that process. It all depends on the details of what the initial conditions are. I found cases like that where the stars would fly by and there would be minimal disruption in other things that I didn't show today.
Two questions. One maybe also more a little to the N-body people. Is it actually possible to have two of these chains of runaway collisions in one cluster? And one more specific to you, how much mass do you actually shed in this process? So actually, how much mass do you have for the production of the second generation?
Yeah, those are good questions. It's usually the most massive star in the cluster, which really dominates and skyrockets. But as you saw in his simulations, there are multiple stars that are becoming larger and larger. And so although there's a dominant member, there are a number of stars that are going through this runaway collision process. And I really think it needs to be studied in more detail. It's been studied in sticky sphere a lot, but what one really needs to do is be able to run a simulation of a cluster with an embedded gas and see how many chains are going on, how much mass is available, and so forth.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, the time between the formation of these objects and their disruption, because they must lose most of their mass, you have enough time to produce some helium, enough helium, let's say.
Yeah.
I don't know if you thought about that.
Well, I think it's similar to the massive star problem that we had before. Most massive stars are going to generate significant amounts of helium within a couple mega years. I mean, that's what's setting the time scale. And so if that rotating mass of star is able to give out the right amount of helium, I imagine that this scenario can as well, because these runaway collision objects, they're going to be a lot harder to study in a stellar evolutionary sense than to try to imagine what the dredge up of helium from the core is like and so on. But it should be there.
Do you mind if I answer Peter's first question?
Great.
So the question was whether or not you could get multiple of these runaway chains happening at the same time in a cluster. There's this great thing called the coagulation equation analysis, and it's in Mark Freitag's paper. He shows that for what's happening here, namely stellar collisions, the cross-section of the merger that you form is sufficiently large that it's going to gobble up any of the other stuff around it. It's the one that's preferentially going to merge. So according to this analysis, you only get one of these runaways. Now, that's in the case of direct single-single collisions. When you have collisions that occur during binary interactions, the situation is slightly more complex. But if you apply the coagulation equation analysis, you can actually get multiple chains. And from some simulations, we found cases where we formed two of these very massive stars.
All right. Thank you. So let's thank Jamie again. And the final presentation will be by Adrian Kuhl on helium core white dwarfs in NGC 6397.
Okay, I know everyone's anxious to leave. I'll try to be really quick. I just wanted to say first, what button do I push?
I thought I pushed it, right? Mm-hmm. Right, doing your function, whatever.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to say something brief about a class of stars that might provide a new window into binary populations in globular clusters. And since I can't say very much in 5 minutes or whatever, you can find out more from Rachel Strickler. This is based on her master's thesis work, and she's got a poster up. And so I'll do the quick advert for it. So the data set looks like this. It's the center of the cluster. And where's their pointer? Let's see, maybe. Ah, here we go. Perfect. Center of the cluster out, extending out to about the half mass radius. And we took data in three different filters. And here's your classic color magnitude diagram. There's about 400 white dwarfs here. And we're also looking at H alpha, in which the main sequence looks vertical. And then you get the horizontal branch and blue stragglers looking H alpha faint, and all the white dwarfs looking H alpha faint. This is a very useful new feature of this diagram now that we can go so faint with the ACS. And what I want to talk about here are some little guys that are right above the CO white dwarf sequence right there. So the stars we're talking about here are these big circles. We did a lot of work to try to figure out what's real here and what's not. And the bottom line is we think that the big circles there are stars that really are in this area, not just bad photometry or confusion with other stars. You can ignore the small circles. So basically, we've got about 24 objects that we think are not CO white dwarfs and not fully measured. And one of the interesting things about them is that these triangles here represent the cataclysmic variables that we know about in the cluster, which are found initially by their X-ray emission. And some of them, four of them, lie in a similar, actually five, one, two, three, four, five, lie in a similar part of the diagram. So how do we know that all these objects are not just cataclysmic variables? Two reasons. They're not X-ray sources, at least down to the limits that we have, which are pretty faint already. But also, they are H-alpha faint. So if they lie along this track, this is a DA hydrogen atmosphere track for the CO white dwarfs. And the these other objects, which we think are helium core white dwarfs, I'll show tracks in a minute, lie pretty much along that track, whereas all the CVs are, relative to the white dwarfs, are H-alpha bright. Some of them not very, but relative to the white dwarfs, they are. So why do we think these are helium core white dwarfs? Here are some tracks of models going from 0.17 up down here it's 0.45, but these three tracks are 0.17 up to 0.25. Solar masses, and we've got different, we don't know what the thickness of the hydrogen envelopes on these things are, so we've got a couple different models here to kind of span the range of possibilities, hopefully. And bottom line is these big green circles land on the tracks that correspond to roughly 0.2 to 0.3 solar masses. So the interesting thing is if we now look at the radial distribution of them, there are a lot of things here. I'm just going to point to two things. This is the turnoff. These are the turnoff stars, 0.8 solar masses roughly. These, the dark green line is the 0.2 to 0.3 solar mass helium core white dwarfs. They're much more massive than the CO white dwarfs, significantly more, I should say. KS test says 0.2% probability that they're drawn from the same population. I won't go into the details, but we estimate that the mass is something like a bit over one solar mass, or 1.2 solar masses. So that means that the companion mass needs to be somewhere around one solar mass in order to explain their extreme concentration to the center. So essentially what we're looking at, we think, is a set of about 20 plus double white dwarfs, helium, one very low mass, and one kind of high mass. We can also say something about the binary fraction of these kinds of objects by looking at their cooling rates and figuring out their formation rates. They won't go into the details, but say that it depends a lot on which, whether you think the envelopes are thick or thin. Bottom line is we can come up with a formation rate somewhere around 5 to 25 such objects made per gigayear. And comparing that with the rate at which stars are turning off the main sequence, we get that a few percent, 1 to 5%, something like that, of turn-off stars have a heavy CO white dwarf companion. That's assuming that the companion is what's responsible for the creation of the helium white dwarf. Namely, as the turn-off star, let's say, was climbing the giant branch, it encountered a companion, namely a CO white dwarf, and lost its envelope to that companion, and thereby we get the helium core white dwarf. I'll just mention really quickly, it's kind of neat. These things you can pick out just by eye in a color image. They look very distinctive in color, little aqua-colored stars in this particular rendition. And that's some old WIFPIC 2 data, actually. And last thing I'll mention is, and I won't be able to go into the ramifications of this, but their ages depend greatly on which, what their envelopes are like. They, either the sequence ends somewhere around a gigayear, and we incidentally, we think it really does end, and that we would see more objects down here. We're still quite complete up here. So if the envelopes are quite thin, they cool quite quickly, it ends at a gigayear, and so where do they go? There was a suggestion by Hansen and others a few years ago that those binary white dwarfs would either exchanged out of their binaries or merge on the time scale of a gigayear or so. But most of these are not in the core where that prediction was made for. So we actually, we're not convinced that that's really going to happen. And so it's possible that they have thick envelopes and that we're seeing them down to very old ages. For these particular models, probably too old. So some adjustment would need to happen to make sense of them because that's older than the probable age of the cluster. Okay, I'll just summarize. I won't repeat all that and just say two things. Faint blue oddballs in globular clusters are not all cataclysmic variables. They may be helium core white dwarfs. And there are a lot, we've seen a lot of color magnitude diagrams that have UV bright objects. I think it'll be fun to see if any more of those are helium core white dwarfs. And also, the main sequence binary fraction is not the total binary fraction in the cluster. Here's an example where you double the number that you think you have if you consider these kinds of binaries.
Okay, let's thank Adrian. Okay, we got time for a couple questions. Harvey?
So this looks like a supernova type one factory in a sense. I mean, would you expect supernova out of these things?
You know, because we don't know whether these things went through common envelope evolution or stable mass transfer. Their periods at formation should have been a few days, but at present we actually don't know what kinds of periods they have. So how long it'll take something to happen to them. The combined mass is something on the order of, 1.2 solar masses or so. So, doesn't go over the limit.
So you think these objects are still binaries? Are there any possibility to see, for instance, transits or something like that?
Sorry? See what?
Eclipses or something.
Oh, gosh. Eclipses, wow. They're so tiny. I mean, what are the chances that... What do you mean? Depends on the separation. That's a very good point.
Okay,
if they were really close, we could have a chance.
I want to ask a real quick one.
Yeah.
You're just making a guess at the fact that they have solar mass white dwarf companions based on the mass aggregation, right?
That's right.
Could they have pulsar companions instead?
You know, all that one solar mass is sort of the average. First of all, there is a known pulsar in 6397, and it doesn't coincide with any of these. It coincides with sort of an...
How good are the data in that cluster, Scott? Is it southern? Is it too far south for GBT?
It's very different looking. That's right. So anyway, in principle, some of them could have more massive companions and some lower mass companions. It could be a mixture. We can't tell. This is just a sort of population average.
Any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Adrian and then go to dinner.